Hola, hola, y bienvenidos a Tu Salud, the definitive podcast for Latine and Indigenous health policy, where we talk about all things Latine, policy, and our health. I am Dr. Ceci Aquino, Executive Director at the Latino Coalition for a Healthy California. And today, I am joined by the wonderful Connie Chung, CEO at Asian Americans Advancing Justice. Today, we'll be talking about the power of women in positions of power, the beauty of immigration, and the commitment to advance justice for our communities in partnership, Latine and AAPI communities working hand in hand. So with that, join us. Well, Connie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so excited to have you. So, you know, just to give you a little background, right, on this podcast, A Tu Salud, To Your Health. Our vision was really to tell our stories, to connect at a human level. You know, we're all about the work, health policy, health justice. It's so easy to get lost in the weeds and, you know, hit the data points, hit the talking points, but rarely do we make time to get to know each other. And that is the goal of this podcast, to really connect with one another, have a coffee, you know, share some time together, and connect on our stories. And so let's start there. Would you mind sharing a little bit more about your story, who you are, what makes you you?
Yeah, I'd love to. And thank you so much for the invitation. I'm looking forward to the conversation. So I am the CEO of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Southern California. AJ SoCal is the nation's largest API, Asian Pacific Islander Civil Rights and Legal Service organization. We serve about 16,000 clients a year, predominantly through our Los Angeles and Orange County, but we also have a policy team that does a lot of work in Sacramento, so we have a few staff up there as well. My background is that I'm a second-generation Korean-American, so I was the first person in my family born in the United States. My parents came from Korea, and they were born around the time of the Korean Civil War. So their families were from North Korea, and they had to flee south during the war, so they were both refugees. And they were both able to, even though they came from poor families, to go to college and go to go to medical school. So my mom got a scholarship from a missionary to do that. And when she went to medical school, she met my dad. And in her class, there were some like 150 men and something like 5 women.
Wow.
So there was quite a disparity, but I always say it gave her some leverage in the dating game.
Okay, I like that.
So when my dad was pursuing my mom, she made it very clear to him that I am moving to America. And so if you want to be with me, we're going to go to America. Okay. And I think for my mom, being a professional woman, she knew that her options were limited in a country that was so patriarchal and Confucianist. And she was also limited coming from a family where there was domestic violence and, you know, having an abusive father and watching what her mom went through, as well as her and her siblings. So America was an opportunity and freedom both for her as well as for her children. So she came to the U.S. I was born here, and eventually she sponsored all of her relatives, and my father did as well. And so most of my family now is here in the United States, and I was raised in L.A. Okay. and went to law school thinking I had some vague notion of I wanted to save the world or help the world or do something, and I didn't know what that looked like. And somebody told me a law degree would be a good way to do it. And then I was a public interest lawyer for about 7 years, practicing in civil rights litigation, and decided I hated being a lawyer because no one likes lawyers. and I ended up also feeling like I was working at mainstream nonprofits where I never saw my community members. And I just felt like I wanted to be around other Asian Americans. So I took a job as the executive director of a social service organization serving Korean immigrant families. And we did mental health, domestic violence, and child welfare. And I loved my job. For 11 years, I was working in my community, telling everyone I was a recovering attorney and really enjoying the services we provided to our immigrant communities.
Right.
And then the pandemic hit, and I was asked if I could take over this position from our founder, who was looking to retire.
Okay.
And at the time, I kept saying no, because I loved my job, and I also didn't really want to go into the legal field, and it was a much bigger job, and I was worried about trying to raise a family and taking on such a busy job. Mm-hmm. But then when the pandemic hit, we saw the rise in anti-Asian hate that my community and I saw, but it didn't seem in the beginning like anyone seemed to care outside of the Asian community, which was frustrating. Yeah. And then we had the murder of George Floyd. And through the Black Lives Matter movement, there was this public reckoning in our country around systemic racism and anti-Blackness. And we were having this discussion that didn't exist when I was making my way through the ACLU and as a civil rights lawyer.
Yeah.
And at some point, I remember thinking, what we're living through right now in the pandemic and Black Lives Matter and anti-Asian hate, this is history in the making.
Right.
Right? My kids, when they take U.S. history in high school, there's going to be a chapter about what we just went through. Mm-hmm. And their kids are going to go through that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, they're going to ask me what it was like, future generations, to live through this period of the pandemic. Just the way when I was in school, I would wonder, what was it like to live through the civil rights movement? What would have been like to know Martin Luther King? Mm-hmm. But I came from an immigrant family. We had no context for that. But I am going to have context for what happened in this country during this time.
Right.
And I thought to myself, when future generations ask me, it's going to be important for me to be able to say I was doing something about it. I was part of the movement. I was part of the solution. So that's how I ended up taking the role I have today.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
You know, I saw myself reflected in your story, especially around coming from an immigrant background, right? I think immigration is one of those social determinants of health that really connects our stories. It provides a frame of mind, right? I think immigration looks different for every family, but it's a unique perspective that we bring into the work and into the way that we see relationships. We're able to find community wherever we go because, you know, many times our families are left behind in our countries of origin and we have to create a new family wherever we're adapting to. So just wondering, what was that like bringing that immigration perspective into your personal life, and then eventually how does it infuse your work now?
So I will say it took a long time for me to accept this identity as, you know, an Asian American woman, a child of immigrants, a woman of color. And I think it was probably at least 10, 15 years into my professional life and career where I felt more comfortable being in my own skin. But I think coming from immigrant families, some of the things I attribute my very strong work ethic to having immigrant parents. My parents had to hustle. You had to, if you want to survive in this country as immigrants, you were sacrificing everything. And so I learned that from them, what it's like to work hard and to hustle. I think coming from an immigrant family, I also learned the importance of the family unit. And I think also as women of color, we are taught to be the caretakers for our family and we're responsible. So it's never just about yourself as an individual. It's about what do you bring to your family? What do you bring to your community?
Right.
And that's why I think women of color make such exceptional leaders in the nonprofit space that we're in. Because we naturally are wired to take care of community and others. I think sometimes what we do is we don't always take care of ourselves. And so there's actually a space that we have that we created a few years ago called the Sisterhood Trust. And it's made up of women of color leaders from some of the leading social justice organizations in Los Angeles, like Brotherhood Crusade, Community Coalition, Caresen. Thank you. And it's all about how do we learn to take care of ourselves, because you know, we run our organizations, we take care of our communities, we take care of our families. But how do we also balance that with making sure we take care of ourselves? Because we need to prevent burnout. We need to take care of our health if we're going to be in the job and in these movements for the long run.
And I love to share that with my team because, you know, like you said, we learn this hustle culture from our families, and we're wired to go, go, go. And these jobs will take as much as they can, right?
Absolutely.
We're passionate about the work because it's so close to our hearts. And it's that commitment that really pulls us and can keep us tied to the work. But, you know, something that I believe is that work is a privilege, right? We have this privilege to come into work and do this work, but it's not our identity. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so key to remember that, especially for our mental health, like you said, to be intentional, to take care of ourselves and hold each other accountable. So I love that you guys have that group.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I think it's one of those things that in theory, it makes more sense than in practice sometimes. Right. And I think we sometimes forget it, but it is something continuously to practice is how do we hold that space for ourselves? Mm-hmm. And if we want to take care of others, we also need to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Another theme that you brought up in your introduction, just thinking about the pandemic and this trauma that we all went through together, right, as humanity. The unfortunate racism, the unfortunate negative rhetoric that we saw around most of our communities, communities of color, were highly targeted during this time. You know, how do we recover from that? What are your thoughts? You know, for many people, they're tired of wearing the masks. Mm-hmm. They're ready to keep going. But our communities are still deeply recovering from the pandemic.
Yeah, absolutely. So as an Asian American, I saw it from the perspective of my community was scapegoated for the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And this is something that happens in American history throughout time, is that when the U.S. feels threatened, whether by disease, by foreign powers or national security or economic challenges, and the country feels threatened, often the U.S. turns to Asian Americans and scapegoats our community. And it's because we're seen as the forever foreigner, or always the outsider, right? And, you know, this is not just to Asian communities. I think this happens a lot to Latinx communities as well.
Yeah.
But for our community, what it meant was the pandemic hit, and you heard China virus, Wuhan virus, Kung flu, and community members were being told to leave this country, go back to your country. I mean, this is our country. And I still remember my father-in-law was walking down the street in Alhambra, and somebody told him, called him a racial slur. Now, he is of Chinese descent, but he's also a U.S.-born citizen from Amarillo, Texas, who fought in the Vietnam War and is decorated for service for this country. So you don't have people much more American than that.
Right.
But he will never look American enough because of his Asian face. Mm-hmm. And what was really traumatic for our community, you know, especially at the height of it with the Atlantis massacres and some of the killings that were happening, is we felt so targeted and afraid that I talked to a lot of people who said, I'm scared to go outside or take the bus or the metro or go to the park. And they were saying, I'm more scared of that than I am of catching COVID. And you think about it, it's a sad state when, as Americans, we are more scared of our fellow colleagues and neighbors and coworkers than we are of a disease that took millions of lives in this country. And so, as a community, that was a lot of trauma during that time. But I think the silver lining was it was also a period of awakening. I think it really galvanized Asian Americans to say, we need to speak up for ourselves. We need to speak out. I think it also was a reality check for some folks who I think kind of bought into that model minority myth, this idea that, oh, as Asian Americans, we are successful and we're doing so well. And really this kind of almost this mentality that we're sort of white adjacent. And I think this was a rude awakening that no, we are subject to racism. We are targeted. And in doing so, it forced a lot of Asian Americans to say, this fight for racial equity, racial justice in the country, we have skin in the game. It is our fight too. And I think historically Asian Americans have been used as sort of a wedge because of that model minority, that we stand below the white, in a white supremacy structure. We're below the white population, but we're above the black and brown population. And that's been used to kind of pit us against black and brown communities. Yeah. And I think what was the silver lining of all of this was the rise in anti-Asian hate told us, no, we are invested in the fight for racial justice. Mm-hmm. And that anti-Asian hate was happening the same time as Black Lives Matter. And these movements were really so active in the pandemic time, meant there were opportunities for more solidarity.
Yeah.
And so I think it was both a really traumatic time for our community, but also it really opened the doors for, I think, our community to think differently about what does racial justice and solidarity and coalition building look like. And so I do hope that that is going to continue to come forward after the aftermath of the pandemic.
I couldn't agree more. I think that solidarity is what makes this movement sustainable, right? It's only when we work hand in hand, pulling each other up to make sure that everyone is well, that we can move the health equity, the justice work ahead. We can't succeed in addressing these issues unless we do it together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes we do get stuck in this sort of mentality of like, my community needs this more than anyone else. And that's how white supremacy, the structure of racism works, right? If we continue to do that, then we're just pitted against each other. And as long as we're fighting for scraps for just our one racial group, we lose our eye on the prize, which is all of us are going to be benefiting if we address racial justice. Yeah. If all communities of color benefit, and we can only do that by working together.
Exactly.
So I think that's something that I think we sometimes slip and lose that sometimes. I mean, we saw the ugly example of that with the city audio leaks, right? Yes. When communities were kind of pitting against other communities of color. But if we can fight that urge to get too insular and kind of think big picture about it, that's how we're going to address health disparities. Yes. That's how we're going to address racial justice. That's how all of these things are going to be really addressed.
Exactly. You know, now that you bring the audio leaks up, that unfortunate and deeply disheartening example actually brought to the table a strong partnership with Cielo and our Indigenous partners, MICOP, CBDIO. And we had to have a very transparent, honest conversation about the racism, the classism, the anti-Indigeneity, anti-Black sentiments in the Latina community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it starts at home. How are we addressing these issues with our beloved family members who might use, you know, race as a way to nickname or use derogatory language? And starting there, having those really important conversations at home so that we're creating a cultural change with the narrative that many people have been brought up with and saying, that's not okay. You know, we need to change this so that racial justice can be well and alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's not just racial groups where you see this hierarchy. As you pointed out, even within a racial group, you see colorism or this, subjugation of different subcommunities. So in the Asian American community that I'm with, I, being Korean American, I belong to the more privileged East Asian community. And folks in our South Asian, or especially our Southeast Asian community, are often the ones who are more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so, and then our organization not only just serves the Asian American community, but we also serve the Pacific Islander community. And the Pacific Islanders are a group that really often get the short end of the stick, and they're often really invisibilized. So, you know, within our organization, I always think about, I think our strategy has to be what bell hooks called to go margin to center. Mm-hmm. If you focus on your most marginalized groups and you center them in your work, then everyone will benefit. Mm-hmm. And so as an Asian Pacific Island organization, I'm always calling for us as a marginalized community to be centered. Mm-hmm. But even within our API community, always looking at who are the marginalized groups. Right. Whether that's ethnic groups, whether that's the LGBTQ community, different groups who are in the margins of our community, and how do we center them in our work?
100%. And I think it's that intentionality that makes a difference at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the part that sometimes larger when I see like public policy or public health. It's harder for people to see that because I think they think, let's hit the largest number of people, right? Let's get to the biggest groups. Let's, that's the best use of our resources if we can get to 1,000 people instead of going to this one community where I can only have 100, right? It's always more time and resources to reach the underserved populations because you really have to go deeper to get to them. But that's what is really going to make the difference. That's what's going to move the needle, is when we spend the extra resources and time to reach those communities, the indigenous communities, the smaller communities, in order to lift them up. Otherwise, to say that we served, you know, the low-hanging fruit, that's easy to do.
Right. And you talk about numbers, right? And I think numbers speak, it's a specific language, right, that we use within our systems to either delay work or advance the work. And, you know, we really appreciate the work that's been happening in the AAPI community with data disaggregation. And we really learned as a blueprint from the AB 1726 work that you all led with other amazing organizations to advance that data disaggregation. And in the past 2 years, we've been advancing a very similar bill for our community, for the Latina community. But, you know, we have those behind the scenes, very important conversations about where did you start? How is the process? Where's implementation? And I think it's that partnership, right? Learning from one another, saying, hey, maybe we don't have all the answers, but we can work together and learn from one another to advance racial justice.
Absolutely. And I think between the Latinx and the API communities, there's such a ripeness for coalition and work together. Here in California, The Latino community is the largest community in the state, right? It's 42% or so. Asian Pacific Islander community, we're 16%, but we're the fastest growing racial group. You take the largest racial group, fastest growing racial group. When we work together, it is so powerful what we can do. And we are the two communities that have the highest proportion of immigrants. And so things like language justice is really important to our communities. And when we collectively work together to address that, or, you know, healthcare for all, for our undocumented community members, it's so much more powerful than if we just do it alone. And to your point about disaggregated data, you know, for us, we know data, I had a Pacific Islander community leader say this to me, data has been used and weaponized to keep certain communities invisible for the Pacific Islander community. That is definitely the case. We know Pacific Islanders had the highest rate of COVID-related hospitalizations and deaths of any group, but that was lost because they were a relatively small community in terms of absolute numbers. And so when we disaggregate the data, you can actually start really looking at the numbers for different groups. Yes. And we know, my policy director always says, good policy comes from good data, right? And so when you have this aggregated data that says, you know, Asian Americans are faring well in school, that's one piece of the story. But then if you really break it down and you see Cambodians in Los Angeles have some of the highest dropout rates, aligned similar to the Latinx community and higher than the Black community, higher than the white community, that's important to know because then we can actually have policies that are tailored to that particular community.
Yes, and guiding the resources to where they need to go. So we're being more efficient.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you mentioned those percentages, right? The 40, the 16%, we add the Black community at 5%, we add the Native community at 1%. That is well over 62%. And if we look at that holistic number, we're more than 50% of the population in California. So it behooves the state to take care of our communities together, right? It's a sound investment, is a sound economic decision to keep our health, to keep us well.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so glad you're doing this podcast because you're showing representation of what leaders look like and that leaders can look like us. They can be women of color from immigrant families, right? Because I think what people forget is that people of color in California, like you said, we're 60+% of the population. Yet when you go to corporate boardrooms and you look at the C-suite, it doesn't look like that. When you go to the state capitol and you look at the Senate and the Assembly, it doesn't look like that. And so right now, those who have positions of power, those who are leading policy, those who drive money and influence our resources still don't look enough like us. And we need people to see that leaders can look like us. Yes. People can, you know, you can be a baller and go and, you know, run the Senate and be a woman of color, right? And that's, we need more young people to see that and to do that, because I'm sick of going into corporate rooms or big spaces where it's still all white men. And I'm like, this is California, dude. Why does it still look like that?
Exactly. And as women, we know how to get things done, huh?
100%. I always say, women know how to get shit done. I don't know if I can say that on the podcast.
You can say it.
We get shit done because we have to. We're busy. We're multitasking. We have to do things, and we're effective. And so I think if you want to see hustle, look for a busy professional woman. That's where things will get done.
Yes, yes. I love that. And, you know, you mentioned formal positions of power, right? I think leadership has informal positions and formal positions, but representation matters, like you said. And I really think, you know, and it's an election year, and in a couple of years, it'll be an election year for our governor. Why are we not talking about a Latina, an AAPI woman, a woman of color as the next governor? We need that.
I agree. I mean, come on. We still haven't had a female president in this country. And it's not going to happen in this next election. We're still going to have to wait for like half a decade to even think about that. But yes, here in California, you would think, being the progressive state we are, that we would have a Latina governor at this point, more API leaders in power, more women in power. It's just, we're not there. We still have this legacy of powerful white men who have continued to inherit this positions, and not just inherit the positions, it's they've learned how to navigate these systems of power. One of the things, as I've joined more spaces where my positional power allows me into different rooms and spaces, is I realize the white men in the room who are in these same spaces with me, it's not that they're smarter or more hardworking or better than me or any of my other counterparts who I know. It's just that they assumed that they belonged in that space, right? And they learned how to be in that space because they inherited from their parents or others who was in that space of power. If you have never seen anyone in your family or in your community who's in elected office, of course it feels scary and foreign and unfamiliar to do so. But it's totally achievable for our communities. And we have the power, we have the wherewithal, and and we know what our communities need. And so we are the ones who should be in those positions.
Exactly. And those are the structures, right? Those systemic issues that unfortunately exacerbate those disparities that we're talking about. And it's going to take you and I being in those spaces, continuing to open the doors, right? So that our community members continue to come in, diversify those spaces to actually reflect the California population and transform it from the inside out.
100%.
I love that. And that takes me to this million-dollar question. How do we finally achieve health equity for our communities? What does it take? What's left to do?
So I think there are a couple things. When I think about health disparities for our communities, the first one, and to me, it continues to be one of the biggest ones, is language barriers. That you can't expect community members to access health services or knowledge or education if they don't even understand what's being said to them. And so I think in California, we continue to push for more language justice, more translation, more materials in the languages that our communities serve. Mm-hmm. And I think that's first and foremost.
Yes.
I think the second thing is, what are other practical barriers? And certainly being undocumented is a huge one. And we're lucky here in California, we've passed things like Health for All, and we do allow for services through our public health system that are open to everyone. But this is very recent that this has changed. And, you know, we remember in a previous administration, they had the public charge rule that Trump had, and he was trying to take it all away. And I think for our community, it's also, what is the, if we really want health equity, what is the health data that people are learning in the field? What are they studying? So, you know, when I was working in the Korean immigrant community, the Korean community has really high levels of things like stomach cancer. In Korea, they screen for that. Here in the United States, they don't screen for it because they're not thinking about Koreans as a demographic. So we have established a health system where the baseline data and everything we know about is based on white men. And then for maybe like women's issues or women's health needs, it's white women. But for our communities of color, where we need the support and the health risks that we have, the system has not been set up to take care of us. And so until we really, as a healthcare system, thoughtfully and systematically look at the health issues of our communities, we're going to keep missing things. I was talking to a Cambodian leader who said that her father died of cancer, and it was a really easy form of cancer that could have been screened for, but because they just didn't think about it, you know, he didn't get screened. I mean, he was living in Long Beach, which is the largest Cambodian community outside of Cambodia. But, you know, our healthcare systems are not set up to look out for those kinds of things. And so our communities continue to suffer from a system that doesn't really look at us, even in a state that's majority people of color. It's still set up not to look for us.
Yeah. Thank you. You said that so well. And I think a lot of the joint work that we do, right, speaks to that language access, making sure we achieve justice and advance that for our communities. You mentioned a public charge, you know, and I think our communities are still recovering from the chilling effect that that caused, especially immigrant communities. And unfortunately, where the narrative is going at the federal level, I am honestly afraid that we're going to see this wave again of the chilling effect. And we can already hear it, right? There was a DACA hearing earlier in the week, and the type of rhetoric that is being used to talk about students and undocumented folks is already, you know, sounding a lot like what we heard a couple of years ago in the last election. How do we protect our communities to make sure that they know their rights during this hectic time?
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt right now it's very concerning how xenophobic and anti-immigrant so much of the public sentiment is right now. But one of the things is, even before the Trump administration, even before the public charge rule, it was always so hard to get our immigrants to get the services they were entitled to, especially if they were undocumented, especially if they came from families with mixed status, even if they were documented, but they knew somebody who was undocumented. When I worked at a Korean nonprofit, and we provided mental health services, so we worked with the DMH, and we had Medi-Cal, getting Korean immigrants to come and access our services was so hard because they were afraid, if I access a government service or a free service, somehow my application for citizenship is going to get dinged, right? Or they would think, I'm undocumented. If I access that service and my name is now on this list, it's going to go to the government and I could get deported, right? There was always so much concern. And it took continuous education and trust building mm-hmm. to put some dent in it and to get people to come forward and access services. Mm-hmm. And then when you had Trump come in office and the public charge rule, it was like mm-hmm. it was like we had made 2 steps forward and now we're taking 3 steps mm-hmm. back. And I still see it today. I mean, yeah. our organization worked with the victims of the Monterey Park yes. Lunar New Year mass shooting. And when we were working with them, we were trying to get the victims to access Cal Victims of Crime benefits. There's special government benefits you can get if you're a victim of a crime. Mm-hmm. And we were also trying to tell them you can get counseling services. They will be covered by these benefits. They'll be free to you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And community members were saying things like, I can't access counseling services. They're going to put me into an institution and I will be locked up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, folks would say, I might get deported. Yeah. Even if they were citizens, they thought they might get deported. So there's so much lack of trust yeah. and so much fear within our immigrant communities of what you can do.
Right.
And, you know, we as community-based organizations, it's our job to establish the trust so that way they feel they can come to us. Yes. But you get one bad policy from an administration and it wipes all yeah. of that trust we have.
Yeah.
Someone hears about one raid or mm-hmm. one ICE, you know, officer taking somebody into detention. That's it. The trust is gone.
Yeah. And it's unfortunate because these systems know that, right?
Oh,
they
yeah.
know how to scapegoat. They know how to utilize fear to control our communities. So a lot of that communication that needs to happen in language, right,
yeah.
with our communities has to be about communicating what their rights are, letting them know that they're safe, that they can access those services.
Yeah. So some of the LA-based organizations, we had sent a letter to Mayor Bass saying, mm-hmm. when you pick your next LAPD permanent mm-hmm. chief, keep in mind that you need to protect our immigrant communities. If you want safety in our communities, our immigrants need to feel safe.
Yeah.
And this was a reminder that LAPD cannot be working with ICE. Mm-hmm. Whoever is the next LAPD officer, whoever is the next president of the United States and bringing ICE in, there needs to be a very clear firewall
yes.
that our LAPD officers won't work with them
yeah.
Because that will erode trust faster than anything. And we're very lucky that we have a mayor who is open and understands that and understands that protecting our immigrants will be good because then they will feel more comfortable coming to the LAPD and that yes. will keep us safer. But that's not true in Fresno, in mm-hmm. other parts of this mm-hmm. Country and this state. And, you know, I really fear for some of our community members on what will happen depending on this next election.
Yeah, I am right there with you. But I'm also encouraged by all the amazing work that you're doing. And I just want to say thank you for that commitment. And like we said, you fighting and advancing justice for the AAPI community also advances justice for the Latina community. So I hope that we can continue this partnership, this strong sisterhood, right, in making sure that we're opening doors for all of our communities to step through and live with that dignity that we deserve.
Thank you so much, Ceci. I agree. And I think no matter how hard the work gets, the privilege for us working in the community, working in nonprofits, and being in the front lines that we are, is that we are the ones who make the change mm-hmm. for the community. We're the ones who continue to fight, and we're the ones who are the safe haven, which yeah. becomes all the more important when our rights are being compromised yeah. or undermined.
Yes.
So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you for coming. A tu salud, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Muchas gracias. Thank you.